Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Dr. Ngozi Ezike, a pediatrician and the director of the state's Department of Public Health, typically joins the governor's daily news conferences to give the numbers update on the spread of the coronavirus disease. She did that yesterday afternoon, a couple thousand new cases in our terrible new normal, and 176 more deaths, Illinois' highest single-day total yet. But Ezike did not stop with the numbers update. She went on to acknowledge a feeling that many of us seem to be experiencing as we begin to lose count of how many weeks we've been staying at home, how many weeks we've been living in this disrupted reality.
I know that May has signaled a change, not only a change in the calendar month, not only a change in the weather, the season, but also a change in some people's psyche. The change has highlighted an increased sense of cabin fever and the desire to get out and get back to what people perceive as what their previous normal was, and wanting that back so much. There's so much pressure for us to get back to that normal because we have all faced this unprecedented disruption to our lives.
But the truth, Ezike said, is that we are still deep in our war with the novel coronavirus.
If this was a traditional war where there were soldiers outside of our doors in the streets and people would be risking their lives to be outside of their homes, no one would think about the need to go to work. No one would think about getting their dog groomed. No one would think about getting their car washed. But this enemy is so different. It's invisible. And maybe as a result of that, we have underestimated the power and the destruction of this enemy, despite the very visible fact that more than 2,500 Illinoisans have lost their lives in just 2 months. That's an unprecedented amount of lives lost compared to any time within our Illinois history.
Because of that, Ezike said, Illinoisans must remain as vigilant as they were when the threat of the novel coronavirus seemed more novel and less routine. But in a sort of bad cop, good cop routine, Governor J.B. Pritzker followed Ezike with a vision for the future. It's a plan he's calling Restore Illinois, and it imagines 5 phases of living with COVID-19. As different parts of the state see consistent declines in cases, life can slowly return to some shadow of what we consider normal. For now, that leaves us in phase 2. Restaurants and barber shops are still closed, but hiking and golfing and boating are allowed, with limits and social distancing. Restaurants and schools and daycare centers don't come back until phase 4, although still with social distancing and all of us wearing face coverings out in public. And life doesn't really get back to anything resembling normal until we have victory over the coronavirus.
I know that we all have a passionate desire to return to the sense of normalcy that we felt before the world knew of COVID-19. Here's the truth, and I don't like it any more than you do. Until we have a vaccine or an effective treatment or enough widespread immunity that new cases fail to materialize, the option of returning to normalcy doesn't exist.
As we go to air Wednesday morning, Republicans from the Illinois House of Representatives are scheduled to hold a news conference, over Zoom, of course, calling for members of the Illinois General Assembly to return to the Capitol building and get to work. Hello, hello.
Hello.
Hi there. Oh, that's so much better.
Okay.
Jim Durkin is a Republican state representative from Western Springs in the Chicago suburbs. He's also the House Minority Leader. I called him up yesterday afternoon. We spoke by FaceTime. So am I on speakerphone or how?
Yeah, you want him off speaker?
If you can just hold the phone up to your ear like it's an actual phone, that tends to get the best sound.
All right, this one.
Our conversation covered that call for a return to session, the state's disastrous budget situation, and divisions within his own House Republican caucus about how quickly to reopen Illinois. But I began by asking him what he thought of the governor's plan to gradually reopen.
You know what? I'm still absorbing it. From first glance, it gives even more authority unchecked to the executive branch. So I'm looking at my role, my constitutional authority, the oath of office that I took, and I'm trying to figure out where it plays into that this report that came out today. So I can't get into specifics, and it's something that my staff and I are really are going to be digging into. But at first glance, that's what I see.
It seems we're all in phase two now, right? And I assume you've seen at least the summary. That means restaurants can still only do carryout or delivery. Non-essential businesses can be doing curbside orders. People can go golfing or boating with social distancing.
That obviously was the modified executive order that came out at the beginning of the month,
which seemed to incorporate some of what you and other members of the House Republican Caucus were calling for a few weeks
ago. That's correct.
Right?
It was memorialized in a document to the governor day before he issued his order, but it's something that I had stressed to him on a number of calls, not only with him personally, but also with the other legislative leaders about different aspects of life in Illinois for people and businesses who we felt can get back to doing some things that they had previously were accustomed to. And you know what, every day and every week, there is something new, but we also learn that we perhaps have gone too far in a certain area. Other situations need to be adjusted. And I think that that's a responsibility, at least I'm glad it's getting through. But I'm getting back to, again, I'm glad that the governor did recognize House Republican priorities in the modified order. But it does not speak to what exactly the role of the legislature is during this process. And that, to me, is concerning. It's concerning to Republicans. I know it's concerning to Democrats. And we have a place in this process. We have a constitutional role. We took the same oath of office as the governor did. So I just believe that not only is it just makes sense that when the legislature is under a roof, we're able to accomplish many things with the administration or without the administration. But we have a responsibility that doesn't go away because of this emergency situation that we are living in.
What is that responsibility?
We're the ones who pass laws. The governor can make recommendations. The legislature passes laws. And the governor, upon signing a law, his responsibilities under the Constitution is to execute the laws. But the legislature is the one who ultimately, this is where the process begins and how our state is to be managed, how it is supposed to run, whether it's with the daily lives of individuals or how our businesses, small and large, are to operate. So the responsibilities are equal. But in this period that we've watched this play out in the most unprecedented of times, we can't neglect the obligations of duly elected citizens who are part of state government. Washington and many other states have found ways to reconvene and to get their business done. We're a state that has serious problems, but the problems need to be addressed in a bipartisan manner, whether it's remotely, which we could do, or it's going to be somewhere in Springfield in a safe, healthy environment. And let me just stress that the Department of Public Health has already issued a report and set up the guidelines for the legislature to return back to session in a way which will not compromise the integrity of the health and safety of legislators and their staff.
Why hasn't the legislature come back to Springfield?
I can't speak for Mike Madigan. And I'm dumbfounded that he has not been more forthright with not only his members, but to the public. I have stated, and I've raised this about going back into session, and I hear little or nothing other than, you know, when it's safe, we'll go back. But, you know, we can learn from other states. We're adults, we can make decisions, and we can operate in a safe, healthy environment. But every day and every week goes by, it just places more pressure upon the legislative body in doing their jobs. And to me, if we're setting ourselves up for a few days at the end of May to do a budget and to pass a few important issues that are at least important in the eyes of the Democrats, then we failed. We have absolutely failed.
I want to ask about what a spring session would look like. And it strikes me that with these working groups that are meeting, there is already sort of a shadow session going on. It's just not open to the public through normal committee hearings where people can actually see what legislators are discussing in open session. Does that strike you as a fair characterization?
Yeah, it's fair. I mean, I think if I'm open to having the public listen in on these working group meetings. I asked the speaker last month, I put the idea in his head that we should have our members discuss and talk through issues that are before them in their committees, matters that were important back at the beginning of the year and ones which are still important. I felt that it was necessary because I know history, is that oftentimes we, as it comes close to the middle of May or end of May, we are surprised or we're just kept out of the loop by the Democrats on the major issues. So if we're going to, and when we are going to return to Springfield, I want to make sure that our members are not going to be caught off guard. That is assuming that the Democrat legislators are being truthful and are being transparent about what their ideas are on the priorities of the session as we get closer to its closure.
What are your priorities for this session? What are the House Republican priorities for this session?
Setting aside the budget.
Well, we'll come back to the budget. That's obviously the big one. But yeah, what else?
Here's something is extremely important that has been lost because of the pandemic. Ethics reform. There was a commission that was created last year. A report was due. It has been extended, but with no clear date in mind for the Ethics Commission to render recommendations to the General Assembly, which means, again, this could be another situation where the Democrats will throw together some recommendations and say, take it or leave it in the last minute. Ethics reform is a priority. Property tax reform is a priority. One of the issues that has raised a great concern to a number of our members is how the Department of Corrections, through the governor's office, is now opening up the jail cells for a number of individuals. And we're not quite sure what the criteria that has been used to allow for early release of individuals. And also, I will say the concern is it's not low-level nonviolent offenders. We do know that people who have been convicted of extremely violent crimes, murder and rape, armed robbery, are being part of this process within the Department of Corrections of whether they're, early release or other types of designations that they've given these individuals. We don't know whether or not, here's the most, I would say more important that I'm hearing from prosecutors and also law enforcement. They're not given heads up. Victims aren't being given heads up that people who've committed these violent crimes have been released early from Department of Corrections. That's the whole point of having a constitutional victim's bill of rights. I would want to know if I'm the victim of a crime or if I've lost a loved one through a vicious murder of whether or not that offender is going to be back out in the street. I don't think that's happening.
Doesn't the governor have supreme authority to grant clemency and to release people if he wants to?
He can, but I do know that it doesn't. It does not trump the victim's Bill of Rights.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with House Republican Leader Jim Durkin, and we've been talking about things that the legislature might accomplish when it comes back. Before we get to the state budget, if the legislature comes in, you talked about Department of Public Health guidelines. There are a number of members of the legislature who are just like everyone else in population. There are older members. There are members who have pre-existing health conditions, you might say, that would make them more susceptible to this. How can the legislature do its work in a way that is transparent and open to the public and still ensure everyone's safety?
I will just say that there is not only a plan that was created by the governor's Department of Public Health, but there also is a common sense factor too that we've all been living by right now in our daily lives. But we all swore and took an oath of office that we would faithfully discharge our duties. If there is ever a time for the legislature to step up and get the job done, it's right now. There's issues that are going to that we should address, whether it's going back and reforming our public pension systems, that is going to have a huge strain on this year's budget. We're talking close to $10 billion. Are we going to ignore also this crudely but also offensively partisan redistricting process that we see every decade? There's a way to address that when you have a governor who opposes gerrymandered maps, but we should not let the Democrat majority off the hook. And if we are going to just wait it out until the end of May, that's what's going to happen. The important issues that have to be addressed, whether it's ethics, redistricting reform, pension reform, will just go away.
Let's talk about the state budget. You mentioned the $10 billion pension contribution. That is obviously a large and growing share of the state's budget every year. But that, I think, doesn't even account for the massive investment losses that are probably happening this year from the pension systems on account of the economic crisis. And we just saw the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, as you know, the legislature's nonpartisan budget arm, announced that state revenues were down $2.7 billion. But the year had been going well, so that's only, and I say that with an air quote, only a net drop of $1 billion. But we know there's more to come.
Of course.
How do we begin to dig out of this?
You know how we begin to dig out of this is by meeting and exchanging ideas. And let me just give you an example.
Aren't the working groups doing that right now, though?
The working groups are, I'll just say that they are going through the issues. There are some discussions between our budgeteers, but there really has not been any meaningful or substantive recommendations that have been made. Last May, in short order, within a matter of 72 hours, we were able to negotiate and balance a budget, which was at one point unbalanced, but we were able to meet, talk, and we were able to exchange, I think, some very good ideas of how we can move forward with this budget, have it done in a balanced manner. I'll just say that when we meet and we exchange ideas, we physically meet and exchange ideas, we get things done.
We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The 21st. We're talking with Illinois House Republican leader Jim Durkin. Stay with us. More to come in a moment. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been speaking with Illinois House Republican leader Jim Durkin. We were just before the break talking about the state budget. I want to wrap up just a few more minutes left in our conversation by talking about returning to talk about the governor's stay-at-home orders and the modifications they've been through. Some of those were with the input of you and the other members of the House Republican caucus, it seems. But we have seen other members of your caucus who are not satisfied even with those changes. Representatives Darren Bailey and John Cabello have filed separate lawsuits saying that the governor's stay-at-home orders violate their civil liberties. Do you agree with their position?
Let me just say this. When I took on this position, you know, a few years back, what I felt was the most important statement and the most important guidance I can give my members is that I have to and I will respect the regional differences that we have within the state. Having run for a statewide office, it gave me a greater appreciation many years ago. It gave me a greater appreciation of the regional differences. Not only is it just regional, but it also is philosophical. I have members that are very conservative, but that reflects their district. Representative Bailey is a very principled, conservative Illinoisan, and he has a right to question the issue of the extension of the executive order, as does Representative Cabello. But I look at it that their region looks at this issue through a different lens than I do. There may be a handful of cases in Clay County. In my village where I live, there's almost 20 cases as we speak. There's close to 600 cases in my legislative district and multiple deaths. Everyone would like to get back to normal. But where I live and the people that I talk to, people respect the executive order. They respect that there has to be social distancing and that there needs to be some type of oversight on activities that we take for normal, but we're all in the same position. I want to get back to what I, everybody wants to get back to where they were before this, but there is, I think, a different attitude in this area towards a stay-at-home order. And we're not getting into whether or not, and I'm not talking about whether or not this is violates the statutes of Illinois, but the attitude in my areas and also in Cook County, you'll see it everywhere. Everybody's wearing a mask. People are more than cautious about food deliveries, of talking to people on the street. So it's up here where the cases are and where there has been, you know, we have super spreaders. We have cases that are still at raising at a high level in the suburbs and also the city of Chicago. So my view is going to be different than Representative Bailey's view, but I understand that. I understand that his district looks at it differently because they don't see it. In my district, it's real. It's just not as, it's not pervasive. All they see are businesses that have been shut down without seeing this virus reaching their parts of the state.
I know you said you're still processing what the governor's Restore Illinois plan, so-called Restore Illinois plan, is going to say, but it does have this regional approach. Do you think that's the right way to go?
I think it's a way of looking at it, and it's always going to be in the way in which there's implementation. I will say this, that I'm confused with the designation of health regions based on an EMS map. And I'm going to have to look at that more to see whether or not we should be reviewing the Henderson County under the same rules and process as we consider Peoria, because those are all under that, under the same health region. So I've got to make sense of that. And I hope it does make sense. And I hope it's just not for a visual for the moment. But with this plan, I've got about 12 pages in front of me. And will the citizens of Illinois accept it? I know that the people of Illinois are reasonable, and they're willing to give government some respect when it comes to these decisions. But the plan has to make sense. And, you know, it's still early to determine whether or not what the governor has laid out today is something that we feel is, one, going to, you know, bring at least some comfort to people throughout the state of Illinois that we do have a plan in place, and two, whether or not it's something that is actually, it's feasible and it can be executed on.
Jim Durkin is a Republican from Western Springs and is the minority leader of the Illinois House. Leader Durkin, thank you for taking the time to share your views.
All right. Thanks, Brian. Thank you.